And this is Lena Live. I'm back with my program, which is particularly is going to be very memorable because I have honor to have a conversation with one of the most outstanding journalists in our modern world. We know that some journalists and the quality of the journalism sometimes can be improved, and standards sometimes can be somewhat lower than it used to be. So that will be a fantastic reminder. What does it mean to be a brilliant journalist, historian, philosopher, and writer? It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Mr. Brian Kahn. Brian, how are you?
I'm very well. It's a pleasure to be on your show, Lena. Thanks for having me.
I will just briefly introduce some of your just astonishing personal accomplishments and tremendously wide range of your personal qualities. As I already indicated, you are a journalist. You have your own award-winning public radio program, which called Home Ground on the Yellowstone Public Radio in Montana. And I have to confess that this is quite an incredible show because it does invite and make people very comfortable to share their points of view, very spontaneous, sometimes controversial, but it makes everyone think. So I immediately wanted to thank you for having this opportunity for general population who sometimes feels quite deprived from self-expression. Continue on your accomplishment. You certainly know life from its ground. And you worked as a wrench hand person. Also, I was quite astonished to know that you've been a college boxing coach, which gave me some thoughts to be careful with you.
You've done a lot of research here. It's going back a ways in time.
I see. Well, still it's yours. But also, with no surprise, I confirmed that your intellectual and educational ability has been gained from being a lawyer. Also, your tremendous accomplishments in journalism. Obviously, the center of this program will be your book, which called Real Common Sense. And in a nutshell, this book is dedicated to Tom Paine, to Tom Paine pamphlet, who was a patriot, visionary, and an American founder. And that book was dedicated to this particular pamphlet because he wanted to restore the true common sense in the history, politics, moral standards, and other human values. This is just in a nutshell. I'm hoping that discussion of this book will be immediately connected to the present problems, present challenges. And I'd like to perhaps invite the first question with asking you, how would you feel about perception of your book among young people, people who are struggling to conceptualize the modern society, and the people who can find some answers and some sense of directions?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I haven't been asked that specific question before. It's interesting because young people today in the United States probably more than any other generation in history, have been totally engulfed by what I think one has to call commercial propaganda. And I don't, it sounds provocative to say that, but we have a commercial media in America, and the whole purpose of the media, with the exception of public broadcasting, is to promote the sale of products, to pay for the advertising and the programs. That's how we set up the media, and we maybe will have a chance to talk about that. Young people have grown up totally engulfed in that environment. And one of the points, the fundamental points that I make in the book is that the founders of this country believed in informed, enlightened citizenship as the foundation, the very bedrock foundation for a functioning democracy. They believed in enlightened citizenship. And in certain respects, it's antithetical to a consumption and consumer ethic dominated media. So the reaction of young people has been of particular interest to me, and I have two different reactions. The majority reaction has been very enthusiastic, and I think it's testimony to the fact that we all seek meaning, and there's more meaning in being a citizen and member of a community, whether it's your group of friends or whether it's the larger community you live in or the United States or the world. There's more emotional power, powerful meaning to that than there is to being a consumer, which frankly I think is a demeaning definition of the human being. I did have one young couple, two law students in Pittsburgh during my book tour. They listened to my presentation, and the young lady said, "Do you think possibly the idea of citizenship that you're advocating is obsolete?" And the question took me aback because I hadn't really thought about the possibility that it was obsolete. But that was the that was another reaction. That's the only time I've had someone really question the merits, that is, from a young person's standpoint, of the concept of citizenship, the significance of it. I told her I didn't think it was obsolete, because in a society, someone is going to make the decisions, and it's either going to be that decision-making power is either broadly spread through the population, or, as is commonly the case throughout history, of course, and even to this day, one form of elite or another makes the decisions for the rest of the people. And I think that's a fatally flawed system, and so did the founders of this country, including Tom Paine.
It is critically important to make this intergenerational connections. And even though perhaps I didn't find this particular wording in your book, however, you're strongly suggesting a certain a very powerful fundamental improvement which needs to be taking place in order not only to bring Paine's ideology, practical vision of this country, but also, frankly, to save next generation, because as you already touched on commercial vision and all this shortcut, superficial information makes that much more problematic for development of young people, but also, frankly, makes much more problems for improving education, which you, of course, talking about your book. So my questions would be now perhaps a little bit more detailed, to go a little bit more into some thoughts and ideas which you express in your book. Let's start from structure in our economy. You made some comments and some analysis. I'd like very much for you to comment on this in a connection with the integrity of the government.
Okay, let's take a step back. Our country tends to be forward-looking and a short attention span, but you have to understand where we came from to know where we are today. We are right now living through a prolonged economic crisis. And let me just give you a few numbers. In the last roughly 30 years, between 1980 and 2000, the gross domestic product of the United States went from $5 to $14 trillion, meaning it almost tripled. Productivity of a non-farm worker, that's the vast majority of employment in America, increased 88% during that time. So that's tremendous economic growth. Yet, the average male worker in this country is making less money in real dollars than in 1980 and working 100 hours more per year. Women workers have increased their income, but they're still lower paid by far than male workers. During that same time, if you made $1 million in 1980, you make three times as much now. And the wealth is concentrated in this country to the point where the top 1% of wealthiest people in America own more private wealth than the bottom 90% combined. So what you have there is a reflection of a tremendous concentration of wealth in the United States, as well as the political power that goes with wealth. You didn't mention, I think, in your question, the political system, but there's a direct link between economic power and political power. In the last election, that is a 2010 federal election, nobody was running for president. This is the congressional election to the House and the Senate. $3.2 billion was spent. 80% of the money came from less than 0.25% of the American people. Now, in combination, that tells the story of what's happened in America. When I make my talks, I carry a newspaper clipping, which I have with me while we're speaking. It's the full-page front of the New York Times Business Day section, first page, April 1st, 2010. And the headline reads, "Hedge Fund Pay Roars Back. Top 25 managers averaged $1 billion each in 2009. That's their income on which they paid an average of 15%. Much less than your listeners pay in their income tax. It's hard to get your head around what $1 billion is. It's this much money. If you make $50,000 a year, which is slightly above the average family income in America, it would take you 20,000 years to earn $1 billion. So that has a profound effect throughout our society, in the quality of education, what happens with the media, what happens with democracy. And without fundamental reforms, I argue in my book, we will not succeed as a nation. It's that simple.
Well, it's not that simple, but in fact, your statistic with analysis is quite scary. And if I can make my magnet point right now about education. Since this comment of Secretary of Education, Mr. Arnie Duckman, who said that there is 25% dropouts from school, and I wanted to say immediately that my subjective point to this will be that it is not necessarily very bad, because we cannot speculate what exactly the consequences, reasons, and purposes of those young people who dropped out from school and what they've been doing instead. It can be very productive, productive time or establishing their own path and goals, because the economy is such that people do need some extra working power and income. However, the point I'm trying to make more of academic, and that to me is one of the central pivotal problems, because unless people have conceptual abilities to process information, unless they can use media not only as entertaining, but as a source of knowledge and source of information, this coming up generation will not be able to support whatever founders indeed accomplished. Indeed, something which Tom Paine had dreams for and expressed in his pamphlet. So I guess my question is not to find the answer and resolution in your answer, but just to have a little searching. How would you feel if our system of education will be changing and more appropriately shaped to our modern issues? The old programs, the old laws, even though have classical grounds and it should be absolutely worshipped, but the time and modern digital society forces people to change the way they've been educated. What is your vision for modern education?
Let me go back a little bit, because the purpose of the book was to argue the thesis that the basic founding principles of the United States, the progressive core of the founders' egalitarian democratic philosophy, provides the moral compass for us to navigate a series of critical problems that we face as a society, including education. Okay? So the book, which is very short, it's about 200 pages and written so anybody can read it, who can read and understand what I'm saying, whether they agree or not, consistently tries to connect the founders' thinking to modern problems. So let's talk about education. This is a quote of Thomas Jefferson, 1816. A nation that believes that it can exist both ignorant and free in a state of civilization expects what never was nor never will be. John Adams wrote a letter to his son, John Adams being the second president of the United States, Jefferson being the primary author of the Declaration of Independence and the third president of the United States, wrote a letter to his son saying, I am studying the science of war so you can study the science of engineering so your children can study art and music. The concept of a civilizing education was central to the founders and the Enlightenment philosophy of which they were disciples. So we have to start with that. Now, my book is a short book, and education is a complicated subject. What I argue in the book is there are two things that need to change dramatically if we're going to educate our children. I must disagree with you. The 25% of young people, I've been told I'm wrong, that it's actually 33% of young people that don't graduate from high school in this country overwhelmingly end up living in poverty. The crime rate for those young people is very high. Drug abuse rate is very high. So it's one of the fundamental challenges we have is to find ways to keep young people in school and make education meaningful to them. In the classroom, I argue some very simple reforms. One, because I'm arguing that we need to all remember we're members of a community. We're citizens in a community of citizens with mutual obligations, rights, and responsibilities. I propose that every semester, every child in public school be asked to write a letter to a person they find whose name they select at random in the phone book saying, here, this is who I am, this is my grade, this is what I like, this is what I don't. I want to thank you for helping to pay for my public education. Because the fact is, every student in public school is getting a tremendous gift from the community through the citizens paying taxes, and that's everybody, renters and property owners, to pay for that education. And the young people should appreciate it. And by sending a letter, they express their appreciation, and they also learn the reality of it. And the people who get the letter, the irate taxpayer who is isolated in our modern society from the services they are funding with their taxes, is touched by a young human being. I think it would be very important. Secondly, I propose that to graduate from high school, all students need to pass a basic civics test, very much along the lines of what someone wants to do if they want to become a naturalized citizen of the United States. Immigrants who become citizens have to pass that kind of test. All young people should do that. I believe those two steps are foundational to reminding our young people in this consumer-driven society that they're members of the community. Third, I believe after graduating from high school, all young people should give a year of national or international service as a way of saying thank you for the education they've received. I think it would, in very tangible ways, expose them to the broader world, the bigger world than they lived in growing up, make a contribution to the moral health of the country, and earn the respect of older people so that, again, it's a way of bonding the community. Fourth, this has not to do with the public school system, but with the misuse of electronic media. In my opinion, commercial media cumulatively in America is a travesty. The average child sees 8,000 murders by the time they're 12 and 200,000 acts of violence by the time they're 18 on television. Totally inexcusable. My book discusses some ways to reform that. But in addition, I propose that there be levied a 5% tax on advertising, commercial advertising, and that fund, which would be 32 times, if my memory serves, I haven't looked at the book in a couple of weeks, the current budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would be used to broadcast educational programs, world-class educational programs for all age groups, world-class class public service announcements reminding people about how we are members of a human community, both national and international, and using the public media for its intended purpose. If you go back to 1934, when we just had radio in this country, the Federal Communications Act was passed as New Deal legislation during the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt. And an agreement was reached between the commercial and non-commercial interests. Commercial interests would be allowed to use the public's airwaves, which are used by cable and broadcast television. They could make a profit from it, but they had to serve vital public purposes. All that's been forgotten now, so we have very little quality news, very little educational program, almost zero on public, on private broadcasting. The requirements that used to be enforced when television came in for controversial and interesting educational programming have all gone by the boards through the lobbying of corporate interests, and we need to retake a portion of the public's airwaves for fundamental public purposes. And that way, I think we can begin to re-educate our young people and achieve the goals set out by Jefferson and John Adams.
I need to remind my guests that I have extremely rare opportunity to speak to true journalist, historian, and truly statesman, Brian Kahn, and his book, Real Common Sense. Brian, your book looks deceptively modest. It is indeed extremely small. I would say it looks like a charming gift, yet... Yet it is so powerful, and I was frankly carrying this book in my bag and not only preparing for the program, but I just was learning more of the connections of different parts of the history in the United States, and being Eastern European myself, I found this much more than just fascinating. I found it's real... a situation where priceless advantage of historic understanding can be certainly explained in a very clear, transparent sense. And that's definitely what you accomplished in this book. I like, absolutely my pleasure. I like to make a bridge to politics, indeed, in a connection with the history. I like to make my connection with mentioning the fact that Tom Paine wrote The Rights of Man, and he was criticizing Europeans for unfortunate poverty, illiteracy, unemployment, and wars.
Yeah.
We're having tremendous challenge today with Europe, and if I make just a short observation that for a very short period of time we had a collapse of communism, we had the most vicious explosive power of terrorism, we had certainly extremely challenging and controversial process of unification in Europe, and all of this connected obviously to the United States. How would you make a connection in between the vision of Tom Paine in 1792 with the present situation?
Well, I think that, you know, you could say the good news is everything he said is still directly relevant. The bad news is everything he said is still directly relevant, meaning things haven't changed a lot in fundamental respects. He and Jefferson was our ambassador to France shortly after the victory of the War of Independence, both observed the same thing in Europe under the aristocracy, which was massive poverty of the 99% and opulent living on the part of the 1%. The number percentages obviously are approximate. Jefferson wrote something, and I don't have the quote right in front of me. He said, "I can use no other description but then the rich prey on the poor." Now, we have a world now that has become much smaller due to the speed of information and transportation. It is one world we live in. And the tragic truth is that we still live in a world where the large majority of people live in abject poverty, where getting adequate nutrition is a daily struggle, and medical care is a scarce and unaffordable commodity for probably at least half of the people in the world. The consequence of that is that it makes the world a very volatile place, because in today's world, we also have what historian Eric Hobsbawm calls the democratization of weapons of mass destruction, which means that desperate people and angry people, and some of them very dangerous people, can get weapons that threaten people who live very comfortably elsewhere, anywhere in the world. So I don't happen to be Catholic, but in 2009, I believe it might have been 2010, the Pope wrote an encyclical called Charity and Truth, and it was a discussion of the inequities of the global economy and called for fundamental reform in all sectors, putting the human being first in priority, in front of business expediency or business needs, short-term focus on profit, the consumer culture. The United Nations just came out with a major report within the last week echoing similar conclusions and pointing to this profound disparity, which not only has terrible human consequences, but profound environmental consequences and national security consequences. So the fact that, I guess it's a long-winded answer to your point, the issues Paine talked about are still with us. It was his belief that the system of democratic participation, where everyday people help determine and have the determining decision over the course of their lives through democratic process, offered hope for moving past the self-serving structure where only the elites benefited. It's still an experiment. It remains to be seen, and our democratic experiment clearly right now is facing serious problems. I side with the democratic argument because I think the history shows that the rule of elites, whether they're communist or capitalist or feudal landed aristocrats, is always self-serving, always short-sighted, and always leads to violent upheaval if uncontested through democratic process. Don't know if that answers your question.
It's certainly opening the avenue for thinking, and your observation and internal vision of it certainly correlates to something which is happening, and your book is stimulating this vision and makes one wondering what's right, what's wrong, but how society is challenged by making certain adaptation to this historic classic rules, if I may say, but also to this modern development. And something makes me to bring one of the expressions which is in your book by Eleanor Roosevelt, which could be heard today. It was expressed in 1934, and it says, "In our complicated modern civilization, we are so separated from each other that we forget our interdependence."
Correct. I think it is one of the fundamental challenges. We're a very inventive species. We're much more inventive than we are wise. We have invented a very fast-paced form of life. It is aggravated, I believe, by the predominance of consumerized media that encourages people to focus on acquisition rather than learning. It's fascinating. It was fascinating for me to come across that quote of Eleanor Roosevelt's. We think of the 30s as very backward compared to what we are today in terms of technology, and that's true. But we have this fundamental problem of being feeling isolated from each other. And I think the potential misuse of technology aggravates that tendency. I'm not a rural romantic. I did grow up in a rural farming community in Northern California in the 50s and 60s, and I live in Montana, which is still a rural state. There is a quality there that I like, which is there is an accepted sense of community. People understand interdependence. We are interdependent in the economy, in everything we do. To survive in a modern world, we're more interdependent than we used to be because we make less of things ourselves. The problem is we have what I call an illusion of independence, and it leads us to be excessively selfish. We're all selfish naturally to a substantial degree. That's part of human nature. But we're also community-minded, and we have to find ways to rediscover our interconnectedness and act on it. When you are a member of a community, you have responsibilities to your fellow human beings. We have to face this challenge now and find ways to make that a real part of our lives. The alternative will not work.
We're going to talk about community. Frankly, I'm extremely passionate about this subject. It has some philosophical measure to it, but also practical expression, which you already mentioned. Before doing so, I just wanted to comment on something which you also made it so clear, the society we're living in, how truly mechanically, very fast, arranged information flashing through our minds, where there is a hardly time to process information. And again, needless to say, I'm always concerned how children can deal with this world. And in fact, they are having extremely challenging time. Sometimes they're silent, but it is our adult responsibility to communicate on this. By the way, I have to say that among many celebrity admirers of your book, Phil Donahue is one of them, and he just said it very directly, give the book to the kids. So I wanted to make connection to one, I think, relevant book for that particular psychological aspect of our society we're talking about. It's a book by Nobel Prize winner in economics, Daniel Kahneman, who wrote absolutely brilliant book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And the reason I mention this is because even though on the surface there is no connection with your book, but indeed it is, if we're talking about quality of thinking, quality of information, understanding our civil and economic responsibilities. I hope that comment served as a bridge to this topic of community. I like for you to step in with your vision. How individual concept, I believe you say we and I, or something close to that, forgive me if I misquote that, but how this concept can find it is me over we, that's what it is. In fact, I have my notes here. How that fits into the life of the community? What is your vision? It is beautifully described in the book, but I like, obviously, to have your points on the air.
Let me comment. Let me start by saying one thing which I neglected to say about technology and young people, because I think young people, it's not just a cliche, it's true, they are the future because they will continue to live, and older people like you and I will eventually get out of the way and make room for them. It is a fundamental sign of hope to me, which I cannot explain. I haven't done enough research. to see what sociologists say, but the generation that has been most exposed to this onslaught of commercialized, consumer-driven propaganda has reacted in a very interesting way. Politically, in what I guess they call it the millennial generation or millennium generation, quite progressive, egalitarian, non-homophobic, international in their frame of reference. Those are, I think, striking things. They have developed with impersonal technology, which the Internet is something that I had a lot of trouble adjusting to, email, that sort of thing. They have found a way to develop communications with that technology, whereas my response to it was, frankly, I think, negative and a sort of knee-jerk, because it has opened up the ability to communicate anywhere in the world. So I think that, that's something we shouldn't lose sight of when we acknowledge that we have the fundamental problems we have to address. It reflects to me that as human beings, despite serious obstacles, sometimes terribly difficult obstacles, people, a part of us seeks meaning through community. We have a private sphere that we treasure and value, and in some ways the founders were determined to protect from oppressive government, but we also have a fundamental need to belong. And that's, I think, because of who we are in terms of our evolution. 90% plus of our time on the earth has been as hunter-gatherers in small bands of 20 to 30 people. The only way human beings survive is because individually we're weak with primitive technology, but as a community of people working together, we could survive. So there was very strong genetic selection for cooperation as part of our psychological makeup. And the penalty for misbehavior was exile from the group, which meant certain death because no one could survive alone. I think that's important to remember, because when we talk about the ability to reestablish vibrant communities of people where we find part of our meaning in our associations, our friendships, our loving relationships, our giving and receiving as members of the community, it can sound sort of Pollyannish and pie in the sky. It is not. It is a fundamental part of who we are. My vision, if I was to summarize it, would be we have created with our inventiveness a fantastic array of different types of wealth, financial wealth, the wealth of knowledge, leisure time, higher education. Those are all resources which can be devoted in one way or another, in one direction or another. So I think the challenge that we face, when it really boil it down, is to, through democratic forums and active citizenship, find ways to utilize and direct those resources to reinvigorate a living sense of community, not just in our towns and our smaller communities, but in our nation and the world, because I really believe without that, the human being's inventiveness will eventually lead to our own destruction. So it's not a casual exercise I'm talking about, and I also think it's not unrealistic. We have to be aware of what we want to do, that it depends upon our being in part members of communities, and begin to do it. And I outline certain proposals in the book related to the United States in terms of modifying corporate law, education we've talked about, media reform, election financing to enable us to move down that road. But the fundamental is, I think, international. It goes beyond the United States.
We're talking about very relevant book, Real Common Sense, written by Brian Kahn, who's a visionary and who is gracious enough to be very diligent in explaining not only his own point of view, but to have a big picture of our society with a connection with a long-term history, if I may say. Tom Paine was his inspiration, and Tom Paine's pamphlet was written in 19, I'm sorry, I keep saying 19, because it is so natural sound, 19, but it was indeed written in January 1776. And it is astonishing how relevant it is today and what a connection we're making. And I cannot see any better way to make a little coda to our conversation by saying your own words and you expressing your vision and saying using our founding values to reclaim our nation and stop the radical right from hijacking America. Brian, your last words, please.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on your fine radio program. And to your listeners, I want to thank them for their patience. If they're interested in the book, I'd love to hear from them what they think about it. But I would just put it this way. We can do this. We just have to put our minds to it and our hearts. We can do it.
And I wanted to thank you very warmly. I certainly wish you many years of writing, hosting your program, speaking to people, especially to young brains. And I wanted also to thank you for being brave, with having tremendous stamina to establish the truth and wisdom.
Thank you.
Was absolutely my pleasure. That was Lena Live. I'm Lena Mirmont. I had another program devoted to our country with a tremendous statement of Brian Kahn and his real common sense, which can bring tremendous sense to our own sense. Please read it and get in touch with Mr. Kahn. He is generous enough to respond. Until next week, this is your host again. It was my pleasure to be with all of you.